We're looking at trucking costs and the milk surplus here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin dairy farmers paid higher trucking costs last year to get their milk to market. And we're talking about takeaways from a new report on milk hauling charges in 2018. Are you a dairy farmer? How has the increase in milk hauling charges affected your operation? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Hope Kerwin is WPR's reporter in La Crosse. Hope, thanks for being here.
Happy to join you.
So this recent report from the Upper Midwest Federal Milk Marketing Order revealed some factors cutting into farmers' bottom line. The cost to haul milk has gone up. What do we know there?
Yeah, so this is an annual report that the Milk Marketing Order puts together, and they found that in 2018, across the entire Upper Midwest region, they looked at hauling charges went up about 8 cents, and in Wisconsin, they went up 7 cents. And so, you know, that might not seem like a lot, but in previous years, they've only increased maybe 1 or 2 cents every year. So this, you know, this 7 or 8 cent spike is pretty dramatic.
Why is this going on? What's happening?
So two things. One, diesel fuel costs have increased, and that could also be influencing handlers, the people who actually haul the milk, to charge a little bit more. But the biggest thing is that as we continue to see a supply outweigh demand in the milk market, basically the economists that I talk to, they say farmers are losing their market power. Processers don't have to offer, to subsidize or even just eat the cost of hauling the milk to their plants, you know, they can really afford to shift that cost onto farmers because they don't need to compete for milk.
So previously, how did these operations subsidize the cost to haul milk? How did processors do this?
So, because processing plants, you know, there's always more demand for milk and other dairy products, you know, they would offer these sorts of subsidies on hauling as a way to attract farmers to, you know, sell their milk to them. And so they would cover half the cost of hauling or even the full cost of hauling. And so that way it would just be a cost savings for farmers and it would, you know, allow them to sell more product in the end. This is pretty common. And they also, plants will also offer subsidies for things like quality or even quantity if a farmer can sell them a lot of milk at one time. And so, I've talked to economists with this, oversupply of milk we see on the current market, you know, they say that we've seen these sorts of subsidies or kind of premiums is what they're called, erode across the industry. It's not just the hauling charge.
We're talking with Hope Kerwin. She's WPR's reporter in La Crosse. We're looking at milk hauling costs amid this milk surplus. And you can join in with what you've seen at 800-642-1234. How is this impacting your dairy operation? And did you see a significant increase this year in hauling charges? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Hope, what kind of impact has this had on dairy farmers that you talk to?
So, you know, as you mentioned, we have seen milk prices continue to stay low for almost 4 years now. And so, you know, they're already facing, return on their milk. And so this is just another way that it's kind of eating into their costs. But it's interesting because as we see, you know, in this time of tough prices, we continue to see more consolidation within the industry. And actually, a dairy policy analyst that I talked to at UW-Madison, you know, said that he predicts that we'll continue to see more consolidation, and we might even see farmers start to look at hauling their own milk as a way to look for cost savings in this area, that as they get bigger, it might become more cost effective for them to hire their own driver, buy their own truck, and kind of cut out the middleman, as it were. So, you know, that's just an interesting trend that we will likely continue to see as more consolidation happens.
Well, certainly lots of upfront cost there in behind tying in their own truck and having to do it themselves. How are farmers, are they working around this, or is this just a cost that they have to eat? Are they cutting corners in any way?
Well, I think we have continued to see dairy farms try to cut corners and cut down on their costs because of low prices. That's just kind of the classic response that in times of low prices, which happens often in the dairy industry, it is kind of a cyclical commodity market. We'll see low prices and then, prices will increase as supply and demand shifts. As we've seen this kind of continued down point in the market, farmers have really just tried to buckle down and cut costs wherever they can. But at the end of the day, it may mean that we'll see more farms close or, as I mentioned, consolidate just because they can't cover all of the costs, their usual input costs to produce milk, and now adding on covering the cost of hauling, they just might not be able to make a go of it.
Hope, do you know, is dairy hauling unique, or are we seeing rising trucking costs, hauling costs across other sectors of the farming agriculture industry, for instance, like hay?
Well, as I mentioned, diesel fuel costs have gone up, and so I imagine that is influencing trucking costs across the agriculture industry. But I think this oversupply of milk is definitely creating a unique situation for the dairy industry. And, just a shifting of, who's covering these costs that will likely continue into the future.
Let's go to John joining us from Oconomowoc. Hi, John.
Hi. I'm just calling in. I am a dairy producer, and our costs of hauling in the last 2 years, traditionally we've been heavily subsidized by our milk processor. The milk processor did the hauling. And over the last 2 years, that cost has escalated to about 35 cents a hundredweight, which maybe doesn't seem like a whole lot. And I'd put that on a percentage-wise basis for you, but I'm driving. I'm probably using my smartphone calculator as I'm driving. But well, on top of that, as well as the hauling, we've also seen a decline in what's called basis, which is the difference between the base price and what we actually get paid, our mailbox price. And that's dropped by about 50 to 80 cents a hundredweight, too. And so there's over $1 a hundredweight there in additional costs or lost revenues that have occurred in the last year and a half. And it is discouraging.
John, thank you so much for the call and for that personal experience there. Hope, can you weigh in on this a little bit, what John is facing here?
His comment about the base price and kind of the difference that some farmers enjoy, I mean, that's just another example of those premiums that I was talking about earlier, that farmers in Wisconsin have enjoyed because of, the infrastructure that we have here. And just as, times have become tougher in the dairy industry and we're seeing less demand for the supply that we have, premiums like that have just eroded, and it's really just kind of, a double whammy for farmers to have lower prices and also seeing some of these premiums disappear.
Hope, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Hope Kerwin is WPR's reporter in La Crosse. We've been talking about increased hauling costs for dairy farmers in the midst of this supply glut. Up next, it is we'll talk with Assembly Republicans who propose to raise the pay rate for public defenders and private attorneys taking on public cases. We talked to Representative Jim Steinecke about that. Stay with us here in the Ideas Network. We're talking about an assembly proposal to put more funding into prosecutors and public defenders. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Assembly Republicans this week called for Governor Tony Evers to include funding in his budget proposal for dozens of additional prosecutors, higher pay for public defenders and district attorneys, and to address shortages and turnover in the justice system. Let's turn to Representative Jim Steinke on this. He's a Republican from Kaukauna, and he's been the Assembly Majority Leader since 2015. Representative Steinke, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks a lot for having me.
So this low pay rate for private attorneys taking on public defense cases, this has been an issue for quite some time now. The rate hasn't been raised since the mid-90s, and at $40 an hour, it's the lowest in the nation. So why is now the time to address this issue, and can it be addressed?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that question. We could have addressed it. We probably should have addressed it before, because what we're seeing now is kind of a backlog of cases, and especially when it comes to public defenders, it's really difficult to find a public defender that's willing to work at the rate that we're offering currently. So what we want to make sure throughout this entire package is that people have a right to a speedy and fair trial. So public defenders are a big part of that, as are the ADAs and the entire judicial system.
Last month, that federal lawsuit was brought against the state of Wisconsin by six plaintiffs who say their right to a speedy trial had been violated after spending a few weeks to over 2 months in jail without representation. So does Wisconsin's low pay rate and this resulting shortage of public defenders, is it violating people's rights?
Well, and that's a good question. That's one of the things that we want to address in this package of legislation, is to make sure that the resources are available so that people's rights aren't violated and they can get access to a speedy trial. We also want to make sure that on the back end of things, that they're getting the treatment, the resources that they need pre-release to make sure that they can be contributing members of society once they get out.
So this lawsuit was filed last month, and then last week the state public defender's office requested that the rate be raised. So how will you and your Republican colleagues work with the public defender's office to ensure that the rate is raised?
Well, I'm glad to say that during our rollout this week, we had public defenders all across the state that were supporting our idea to move this up to $70. So I think we already have their support. We'll now look to the governor's budget when he proposes it next week, and hopefully he'll include our ideas in his budget as well, so we can get this done as quickly as we can.
So this proposal includes a pay raise for public defenders, not just for the private attorneys taking on the public cases. How significant would the public defender pay raise be under this proposal? What do we know there?
I know the Supreme Court had ordered, when they order public defenders to a case, I think their pay rate is $100. So, again, what we're really looking to do is to make sure that the pay is good enough in this market in order to make sure that people are willing to take these cases, so that people can have access to the judicial system in a speedy way.
So looking a little more about the Wisconsin Supreme Court, it's tried to get traction on this issue with lawmakers over the years. And currently, lawyers appointed by judges are paid $70 an hour, but the high court said that starting next year that they'd be paid $100 an hour. Did this have an impact on what lawmakers are now trying to do with the pay rate for private attorneys taking on public cases?
I think everything's had an impact, right? I mean, the backlog of cases, things that are developing on the ground, legislators always respond to things that are happening out in their communities and what we hear from members of the public and members of the judicial system, especially when it comes to cases like this. So we're responding to some of those requests for help and some of the information that we've gotten about backlogs of cases and people waiting to have their cases heard. So, we're doing what legislators do, and we're responding to what we know.
Do you hear from constituents on this issue? Do you hear about a backlog? Are you getting calls in your office?
So not particularly from my district, although, people up in the system up in Brown County and Outagamie County in my district have obviously brought this up. Individual constituents know, but people that work in the system have brought it up.
We're talking with Representative Jim Steinke, the Wisconsin Assembly Majority Leader, about a legislative momentum that we're seeing to raise the pay of public defenders and to put more funding toward this as part of the criminal justice system. You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. You have a line to Representative Steinke about this issue. Representative, tell us a little bit more about the other aspects of this proposal relating to increasing prosecutor staffing, increasing assistant district attorney's pay rate, and expanding drug and alcohol rehab programs.
Yeah, again, this is all about kind of reforming the criminal justice system. As we've seen, even at a national level, there's bipartisan action on criminal justice reform. You know, one of the few areas of agreement that they've had out in D.C. This is an area we think we can come to an agreement with the new governor and our friends on the other side of the aisle on as well. So making sure that people that find themselves in the criminal justice system can get access to a speedy trial, that the DAs have the resources that they need in order to deal with the volume of cases that they're seeing. And then also trying, like you said, through those treatment and diversion programs to make sure, you know, we can do everything we can to avoid having to place people in the system to begin with.
Well, the governor has also hinted that he will have some reform ideas as well as part of his budget. Do you think that there is going to be compromises made here on this particular issue?
I think compromise is the word of the year, right? I mean, we're in a new era in Wisconsin where we have divided government. We're all going to have to be grown-ups about things and make sure that we can find areas of agreement. There are going to be areas where we disagree, and we have to do our best not to highlight those issues, and I'm hoping the media won't focus on those issues in particular, because I think that there's going to be a majority of instances where we're going to be able to find that common ground.
Let's go to John joining us from Lake Hallie. Hi, John. What's on your mind here about this issue?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I understand that the legal system needs to get good lawyers and stuff. But why are people rushing to give lawyers $70 to $100 an hour when teachers, which I think are even more important, can barely get $20 an hour?
So, yeah, that's a good question, John. And one of the things that we've done over the course of the last few years in this last budget in particular, we put in record amounts of funding into education. Now, one of the things that we're seeing in a new report is that that record source of funding is not trickling down to the teachers. A lot of that is being eaten up in administrative costs, so that's an issue that we're going to have to look at. But I agree, we need to get teachers some increases in pay. But as far as the attorneys themselves, in this case, we're seeing sometimes it takes 500 contacts in order to find an attorney that's willing to take a case at that rate. And that's just not something, you know, that we can allow to continue.
Let's go to Mary Kay now in Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay. What are your thoughts on this?
I'd like to see cases heard more timely, because people sit in jails for weeks, even months, before their cases are heard. I'd like to see the public defenders make $100 an hour. I'd like fair payment plans from the state of Wisconsin collection fund, you know, where people have to pay in after they've been released from jail. And I'd like to have truth in the collection payments. Some people are not recording people that have paid the funds into the collection.
So, Mary Kay, you're looking at a lot of, you know, more sophisticated financing here as we look at how to make some reforms. Representative Steinke?
Yeah, like I said, I agree with her wholeheartedly on the fact that we need to get people through the system faster. Get their cases heard, and that's what this whole package is all about.
Do we know how much this package would cost?
So this package would cost right around $50 million. It would also include some about $10 million for retention and attraction of corrections officers, which is also an area of need. So we're trying to address the entire system from beginning to end here.
How will you and Assembly Republicans move forward on this? I mean, it was rolled out Monday all over the state, but in advance of Governor Evers' budget proposal coming out on the 28th, what comes next for you on this proposal?
Well, we're always willing to sit down with the governor and talk about specifics ahead of his budget release. But really, that's kind of where we're at right now, is in a holding pattern waiting for him to release his budget next week. Then we'll have an opportunity to see where his priorities lie. And then we'll have to negotiate from there on some of the specifics. So whether it's criminal justice reform, whether it's education, transportation, all that stuff will be part of the broader conversation.
Well, Representative Steinecke, thank you so much for joining us.
Yep, anytime. Thanks for having me.
Representative Jim Steinecke is the Assembly Majority Leader. He's a Republican from Kakana, and we've been talking about a plan that would address state public defender problems with about $50 million in funding over 2 years. Coming up, not all apologies are created equal. We take a look at what makes a good apology, and if a good apology matters, as public apologies have become a part of our day-to-day in the wake of the Me Too movement. You can join in with your thoughts on how to say I'm sorry at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Apologies are a part of life because, after all, to err is human. And we're talking about how to say I'm sorry on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So how do you own up and take responsibility? Is your apology authentic, or is it more about damage control? Questions we'll explore with you at 800-642-1234. What do you expect out of a public apology? Why do you think so many public apologies miss the mark? Call in with your thoughts, your questions, email ideas at WPR.org. Lisa Leopold is an associate professor of English Language Studies at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies based in Monterey, California. Her recent piece for The Conversation is called How to Say I'm Sorry, Whether You've Appeared in a Racist Photo, Harassed Women, or Just Screwed Up. Lisa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
So looking into that title a little bit more, and, you know, in this era we live in, the Me Too movement, data privacy scandals, the resurfaced blackface photos, there have been a lot of opportunities for public figures to issue public apologies. You know, and some say they're sorry, and some think about a different sort of template for how to apologize. But, you know, time and time again, we're seeing these apologies go wrong. Why does this seem to be such a complex and difficult thing for people to do?
Well, a public apology is high stakes, it's for a serious offense, and it's issued to a broad and diverse audience who may have very different conceptions of what makes an apology sincere. So there was research with 45,000 people, and there is clearly variation in the general public's apology preferences. Most want to hear expressions of regret or acceptance of responsibility, but others would like the offender to make restitution, seek repentance, or request forgiveness. So you can imagine a public figure whose apology leaves one of those elements out. The apology will then seem insincere to at least some of the population. So especially when it comes to public apologies, what is missing is sometimes just as important as what is contained in it.
Generally speaking, how do you evaluate the effectiveness of an apology?
Well, there are many strategies which we can use to evaluate the effectiveness, but I have narrowed it down in my own research to three, and those include an actual apology with the words, I apologize, or I am sorry, with an explicit naming of the transgression. And secondly, claiming responsibility for the offense, because we want to hear ownership with words such as, I did it, or I was wrong. And thirdly, we want to hear empathy for the person who was hurt. So we want the offender to feel bad for how their actions hurt others. And those three strategies, in looking at research from various disciplines of linguists, business ethicists, religious and legal scholars, psychologists, seem to be a common thread throughout.
You've analyzed dozens of these public apologies, really broke them apart. What got you wanting to look at this area in the first place?
Well, it's really partly the reasons that you mentioned. We've seen a proliferation of public apologies lately. And as I teach international graduate students, I also wanted to learn the strategies myself of what makes a public apology effective so then I could teach it to my students.
So before we go on, what are the benefits of getting an apology right, and what are the consequences of getting an apology wrong, or when it misses the mark or the intended audience?
Well, firstly, we've seen that because they're for such serious offenses, if an apology is botched, it can lead to intense criticism of a public figure's character, and we've seen in the recent media coverage of politicians' apologies, it can even lead to calls for resignation from office. Research shows that in the case of corporate apologies, when a CEO blames external factors rather than takes responsibility or assumes ownership, it can even lead to the company's financial decline. So we can see that public apologies are extremely high stakes. Conversely, we're more apt to forgive those who do apologize. So even a less than perfect apology may be better than none at all. And if, in the case of corporate apologies, a CEO assumes ownership for their offense, financial performance is seen to stabilize and then rise over a period of time.
We're talking about how to say I'm sorry with Lisa Leopold. She's an associate professor of English language studies at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey. Your questions are welcome at 800-642-1234. When do you know an apology is sincere from the heart? What have you learned from apologies in your own life? And what do you say when you need to apologize to somebody you love? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Lisa, one person who's come up under a lot of heat recently is Virginia Governor Ralph Northam, who was forced to apologize after a racist yearbook photo emerged. And here's the governor apologizing for that photo in a video statement he posted to Twitter.
That photo and the racist and offensive attitudes it represents does not reflect that person I am today or the way that I have conducted myself as a soldier, a doctor, and a public servant. I am deeply sorry.
So many have criticized how he's handled the situation, but Lisa, what do you hear in that apology?
Well, I'll start with the good. It is good that he says, I'm deeply sorry. But other than that, I would have quite a bit of critique of this apology because he uses that sentence immediately after he said that photo and the racist and offensive attitudes it represents does not reflect that person I am today or the way that I have conducted myself as a soldier, a doctor, and a public servant. So by including that sentence immediately after, or including the apology immediately after that sentence, it's not really clear what he's apologizing for. It almost sounds as though he's sorry for himself that the photo and the racist and offensive attitudes doesn't represent who he is today. And he emphasizes behavior in the past twice. He uses a euphemism, in fact, for his transgression by calling it behavior. And anytime he's using the pronoun I, which is what is encouraged to show ownership, he's mostly using it to say something positive about himself. And even the phrase my behavior is softer when he's talking about his wrong behavior and the harm that it causes. But rather, he wants to emphasize that I have done this and I have done that with positive actions. There's very little attention paid to expressing empathy, although there's an acknowledgement of the harm my behavior caused then and today. He uses that in a sentence where he cannot undo or change it in any way. So he really shows that he wishes not to attend to the past pain of his victims, but rather he wants to emphasize more restoring people's confidence in him. So it strikes me much more as an attempt to restore a damaged reputation than it is about remorse for his actions.
And he has since walked back, saying he didn't believe he was one of the men in the photo, and he also admitted that he had used blackface on a separate occasion. So when you walk back an initial apology like this, how does that sit with the people you're apologizing to?
Well, clearly, it undercuts its sincerity because you're questioning whether there was a transgression in the first place. And the first principle is to apologize explicitly for the transgression. And when you remove that or when you take it back, it undercuts the sincerity of the apology.
Let's go to Kara now, joining us from Fond du Lac. Hi, Kara.
Hello.
What's on your mind about this?
Well, I agree with the three principles that our guest is speaking to, but I'd like to speak to the fourth one, which is the follow-through. An apology is just words unless you actually are really sorry. And how do we know you're really sorry unless you're changing your behavior? Are you sorry because you're trying to save face or because you actually really want to make a change?
Kara, thanks for that. Lisa, what about the follow-through here?
Well, that's also very important, I agree. And in fact, in different research frameworks, there's attention paid to actions or promise of non-recurrence in the future. I did not include those in my three ingredients, but absolutely, we judge people more by their actions than their words. And so most people will examine closely how sincere the apology was based on the change that the individual has made in their actions.
And what about some of the phrases like, I am remorseful, or I regret doing this, but not actually ever saying those two words, I'm sorry, or I apologize? How do you parse that? Is there any respectable apology? Does it have to say, I'm sorry?
Well, as we know, Louis C.K., who was accused of sexual misconduct, actually dodged the apology with words, I'm sorry, in his issue, even though he did, in his issuing of an apology, even though he did include that he was remorseful. So, on the other hand, expressing humility, regret, or remorse is seen to strengthen an apology, so it's very important to include those ingredients. But most people will criticize an apology if it doesn't explicitly apologize for the transgression. It's seen as kind of a dodging of the apology.
We're talking about the ingredients of an apology. Lisa Leopold is our guide. She's an associate professor of English language studies at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. You can join in with your apology critiques at 800-642-1234. What do you say when you need to apologize to somebody you love? And what questions do you have about apologies and the language that we use around them? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. When an apology is in order, we're talking about how to go about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And the importance of apologizing when we have done something wrong is really drilled into us as kids. It's a theme you see a lot in children's literature. And I'm thinking of the Ricky Ricotta books I read to my kids. Ricky's a mouse. And there's one where Ricky explains that making amends is showing how sorry you are. And since his friend Lucy loves flowers, Ricky, and with the help of his mighty robot, they fly to Hawaii to pick some beautiful flowers for Lucy. So how do you go about making amends? We're at 800-642-1234. How do you express a sincere apology? How are you teaching your kids to apologize? Do you set an example? If so, how? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Lisa Leopold stays with us. She teaches English Language Studies at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey. Lisa, Gary from Iron River sent us an email and said, it seems that truly sincere apologies are effective, but poor apologies are often given by people who don't really think they need to apologize or have done anything wrong, but their job or public opinion demands an apology, so they give one. Do you see that happening?
Absolutely. We see this with politicians or with celebrities all the time. And when an apology is forced and it's not coming from the heart or the willingness of the individual, that also undercuts its sincerity.
So let's play another clip here and pick apart Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg apologizing to Congress in 2018 during testimony over Facebook's Cambridge Analytica data scandal. Let's listen.
We didn't take a broad enough view of our responsibility, and that was a big mistake. And it was my mistake, and I'm sorry. I started Facebook, I run it, and I'm responsible for what happens here.
So what are we hearing here, Lisa?
We are hearing that Mark Zuckerberg is accepting ownership by using the pronoun I and saying that I'm responsible for what happens, and that's a strength of the apology. But we also hear it fall short in that he doesn't actually admit to the transgression. Not doing enough is not the same as admitting wrongdoing, because he's actually taking credit for doing something, just not enough. So he's really hiding behind what the transgression was. But it is clearly something in which he assumes ownership for, and it's consistent with what the research shows, that companies fare better when the CEO takes ownership for the problem. But there's a lack of empathy there, which is also consistent with what the research shows, that investors don't necessarily want heartfelt apologies from CEOs.
Let's go to Michael joining us from La Crosse. Michael, what are your thoughts on this?
Hi. I think that apologies are really important to do, especially parents with fear. And I was wondering if you could talk about the way different generations approach apologizing. Do they do it differently? Do they do it in different amounts, that sort of thing?
Oh, that's very interesting. I, as a linguist, haven't really studied the historical evolution of apologies, so I may not be the best to comment on that. But I can comment on some of the things that make an apology sound more or less sincere. So if you specifically name the offense, use the active voice, using I, and a greater number of apology strategies in today's world, that always strengthens the apology. In contrast, what weakens it are the conditional words like if I offended anybody by that, or but to give a justification following the transgression, using a euphemism for the transgression, such as this mistake, rather than clearly naming what it was. And regardless of who's issuing the apology and what timeline, those are all elements that strengthen or weaken it.
So let's look at President Trump and the expectations of our commanders-in-chief and those who run for these particular positions. During the campaign and his presidency, President Trump has said to has had to apologize for various things that he's done or said. And here is then-candidate Trump in 2016 apologizing for his vulgar comments toward women that were captured on an actress Hollywood tape.
I've never said I'm a perfect person, nor pretended to be someone that I'm not. I've said and done things I regret, and the words released today on this more than a decade-old video are one of them. Anyone who knows me knows these words don't reflect who I am. I said it, I was wrong, and I apologize.
I said it, I was wrong, and I apologize, and was never a perfect person. So what do you think about this particular apology?
Well, I do like the line, I said it, I was wrong, and I apologize, even though it could be strengthened by mentioning what the apology was for after the word apologize. But he's clearly trying to dissociate himself from the behavior. Just like Northam does, he's emphasizing his behavior in the past with words like more than a decade-old video, and he's trying to get the public not to judge him by his past actions, which he's really minimizing, but trying to convince them to judge him by everything he's done well. And later in that apology, he's actually focusing more on the supposed or alleged transgressions of the Clintons than on his own behavior, which is really diverting attention. And one of the ways that we critique apologies anytime, as we've seen others do, such as Harvey Weinstein did in his apology by diverting attention to anger to the NRA, or Kevin Spacey when he announced his sexual orientation in his apology. These are ways to divert the public's attention to something else other than the transgression. So it's a technique, and it certainly undercuts the sincerity of the apology.
So most of us listening aren't going to be making a public apology anytime soon with a podium, microphones, a spouse in the background slightly blurred to the left. But I'd imagine we're much more likely to have an issue, a personal apology to a spouse or a family member or a friend. Are the elements of the public apology the same as a personal one?
Absolutely. As we've seen in the research of the general public's apology preferences, which was done by Jennifer Thomas of 45,000 people, we see that most people want to hear expressions of regret in their apologies. So if we follow this framework of, I'm sorry, I did it, I was wrong, I feel your pain, we're going to be effective in our personal life as well. And in some sense, they're easier than public apologies because we know the apology preferences of people we're apologizing to if they're a close family member, loved one, or friend. So we don't have to worry about hitting the top five apology strategies in our apology as we would in a public one.
It seems not a day goes by now where some public figure isn't apologizing for some transgression. Are we in any way getting apology fatigue, and maybe the effectiveness of apologies is starting to wear off on us?
Well, they do say that the U.S. in general is on an apology tour and really expecting this of public figures. I think what we really want to see is change in action. So people are demanding apologies, but they're really looking for the reform in behavior in the long term.
So as we start to wrap up here, can you leave us with one final apology tip for the next time we mess up?
Take ownership over wrongdoing and don't use any strategy to minimize the wrongdoing. And that would include avoiding if anyone may have been hurt, or I apologize if anyone was offended. So always claim ownership for wrongdoing without minimizing the offense.
Well, Lisa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lisa Leopold is an associate professor of English language studies at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies based in Monterey, California. And her recent piece for The Conversation is called How to Say I'm Sorry, Whether You've Appeared in a Racist Photo, Harassed Women, or Just Screwed Up. You're listening to this conversation about apologies here on The Morning Show. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.